So thank you all for coming this evening. There are a lot of thanks to go around. I'll begin with the sponsors. We thank Mark Goldman and Dr. Connie Traub, sponsoring in honor of their children, Jake, Michael, Sarah Beth, and Benny. Dr. Jake Delisker, who are sponsoring in memory of Gita's mother, Rachel Bashmol Zev Zichron Levracha. Michael and Yael Schreiber, who are sponsoring in memory of their nephew, David Dov Chaim Ben Tzvi Akiva Zichron Levracha. And Stephen Luthi Summer, who is sponsoring in memory of Steve's father, Nassan Ben Yehuda, Zichron Levracha. I have to thank Aaron for many, many things that he does around the community of NYU. But the metamorphosis of this class was very interesting, not of interest probably to any of you, but Aaron and I understand it's a kind of metamorphosis. And sometimes the bad news is the good news, and that is that I originally asked him to speak at a different venue. That venue didn't work out, so we managed instead to have a mini-series on Tanakh, which I think is of great value for us. Dr. Kohler is associate professor of Near Eastern Jewish Studies at Yeshiva University, assistant dean of Yeshiva College. He studies the ancient world, including the worlds of the Bible and rabbinic literature, especially material, culture, language, and intellectual history. His most recent book is Esther and Ancient Jewish Thought. Aaron also teaches Talmud Biblical Interpretation at the Jewish Institute. He lives in Jamaica Estates. Didn't say Estates, okay. Jamaica Estates, Queens, with his wife, Shira Hachkola, and their children. And for us, he also duchens. So we really thank Aaron very much for speaking with us this evening, and as well as next Sunday evening. And there are a lot of things following. Please check your emails. People all the time are telling me, oh, I didn't see that. I know we send a lot of emails. Just read them. Thank you.
You can also check yije.org.
Thank you, Rabbi Hochberg. And I want to second the thanks to the sponsors. Michael played a role in organizing it, but the sponsors are also good friends. And they, along with a lot of people here and in the neighborhood, not here, have really done a lot to make us feel welcome in the shul and the community. And it's a special honor and a special set of pressures now standing here teaching people that I like, that I feel so comfortable with, that I'm really happy to be in a community with. All right, so the topic of the Akedah, the binding of Yitzchak, and we're going to say very little about many of the questions that the story raises. There are really dozens, maybe even hundreds of important, significant, weighty questions that the story raises on a first reading, on later readings, many of which we're simply not going to have time to talk about. We're going to focus on one, I think, is a central issue, which is what the story is actually about, what the lesson of the story is, why the story is told. Many people, and I'm not going to bore you with quotations, but it's easy to find quotations in Chumashim, in lots of books about how central and important the Akedah is in Jewish thought and in the stories of the Torah. But of course, if it is so central, then we really need to know, well, what is it saying? What is the story actually about? It's obviously over-trivializing it to say the story is teaching you that you shouldn't kill your children. Although it's plausible that in the ancient world that might not have been as obvious as it seems today, and yet that still seems to be overly reductionist, to really take much of the drama, much of the significance out of the story. A question like, I mentioned the word Akedah. Akedah means binding, but it's not a normal word for binding. Certainly, you would have said Vayikshor would have been a much more sort of common word for Avram tied Yitzchak on the Mizbeach. So one might ask, well, why Vayakod? Why the choice of that term? Why does that become the noun, the binding, the Akedah, that's almost synonymous with this story? It's such a rare term that it doesn't conjure up any other text. There are a handful of other times that it's used in ancient Hebrew. But Akedah is synonymous with the story of when Avram almost killed Yitzchak. That's one question that we won't touch upon. Another question we won't touch upon, but really haunts pretty much any thinking about the story of the Akedah, is the question of the age of Yitzchak. And this is also a good example of how little is actually present in the story in the Torah. Fundamental I don't mean fundamental in the significant sense, but fundamental in the basic sense. I want to think about the story. I want to imagine the story. I imagine an old man who's somewhere between 100 and, let's say, 137 or so, walking for a few days with his son. Well, okay, so the old man, whether he's 112 or 124, might not make that much of a difference in my sort of imagination. Or if you want to use a technique that's very helpful, think about sort of staging it. Think about putting it on as a play. So you're going to have a hard time finding a 112-year-old man to cast in that role. Or whether it's a 124-year-old man, that's almost trivial. But whether it's a 7-year-old boy or a 30-year-old man who's walking alongside him, that makes an immense difference. It makes an immense difference not just in your casting, but in the relationship between them, in what you understand this character is thinking, what he might be experiencing and questioning, going over in his mind. And yet the Torah gives no indication of how old he is. So of course the Midrash, at least the most famous Midrash, does say he's 37, meaning as old as possible. 37 is already a mature adult. And that, of course, has very important ramifications for then understanding the conversations between Abraham and Yitzchak. Ibn Ezra quotes a view that he was 5. That's a vastly different picture of what this child is experiencing, what he might be doing, what the question is when he says to his father, "But Abba, where is the sheep?" From a 37-year-old man and from a 5-year-old boy, those are entirely different questions. Ibn Ezra himself thinks that he's probably about 13, which is an interesting compromise. Old enough to understand, not quite old enough to be on par with his father. But again, these kinds of questions that are so basic to just reconstructing, to just thinking about, imagining the story, are not even broached in the story, in the text of the Torah. The Torah makes no attempt to sketch out for us what it looked like. Nothing about the landscape, nothing about where they were, what kind of terrain they were walking over. Was it hard? Was it easy? We have, in the course of a 3-day walk, we have a grand total of about a 15-second conversation recorded. And it's, on the one hand, obviously conscious that the Torah tells it that way. It's very sparse, very spare. There's very little in the story. On the other hand, if we really wanted to reconstruct it, at least in our imagination, we have to imagine that there's more that's simply not told. But I want to frame our question with a little... I've mentioned this once in a different context, actually at your house, so I apologize if this is familiar, but a wonderful dialogue among the commentators, among the medieval, the Rishonim, on the Akedah, that I think really helps us to frame the core question of the story. The very first pasuk of the story is, Achar Dvar Ma'ele, Ve'elokim Nisa Et Avraham. Which every translation, although not every interpreter, takes to mean that after these things, after these matters, or after these words, God tested Nisa Abraham. But the word Nisa, because it sounds strange and maybe even problematic to say that God tested Abraham, the word Nisa has been interpreted in a number of different ways by the commentators, and already starting in the Midrashim and maybe even in the Dead Sea Scrolls before that. And one view in the Midrash says that Nisa doesn't mean to test, as the normal interpretation of Nisa is, but rather comes from Nis, a banner, a flag. And that when it says that God tested Abraham, it means he held him up like a flag. He held him up as a banner. In other words, he was showing him off. And that's actually the interpretation that's adopted by Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon, back in the 10th century, one of the most important Jewish intellectuals of the in the Middle Ages, certainly of the 10th century, says in his commentary on Bereshit, and actually in his translation of the Torah into Arabic, translates it as demonstrated Abraham to the world. Okay, very nice. A couple hundred years later, Abraham ibn Ezra, now in Spain, in the 12th century, quotes Rav Sadia Gaon and says, "But I reject that. Because in order for that to make sense, there has to be an audience. God is showing Avram to whom? There's no one there. Avram is, and this is something we'll come back to in a little bit, Avram is entirely alone up on the mountain. The only potential audience is Yitzchak, but of course, he can't demonstrate his faith and his willingness to slaughter Yitzchak to Yitzchak on the assumption that Yitzchak's about to die anyway. And so there is no audience, and therefore this is not a plausible understanding of the purpose of the Akedah. It couldn't have been for the audience. There simply isn't an audience there. Another century and a half later, Radak, Rav David Kimchi, now we moved from Iraq to Spain, up to Provence. David Kimchi, in the next century, quotes Ibn Ezra's rejection of Rosh Hashanah, and he says, well, actually, I have the answer to that. The answer is, there is an audience. The audience wasn't Avram's contemporaries. The audience is me and you, and everyone else who reads the Torah and takes it seriously. And Radak then has an interesting comment that in his day, remember he lives in Christian Provence, because in my day, most of the world now reads the Torah and takes it seriously. In other words, all the Jews, all the Christians, all the Muslims, everyone actually looks at this text as a sacred, authoritative text, and studies it with an eye towards learning something from it. And so the audience is massive. It's Rubo Shel Olam. And that's I think, a good introduction to framing the question at hand. Okay, so those are the stakes. And if God just held up Abraham to teach something to the audience, namely us, well then we really need to make sure that we understand what it is that he's trying to teach. This is a question that a number of the Rishonim take explicitly, is that they explicitly say, what is the purpose of the story? But not all of the Rishonim do, and that's an interesting just observation about the way many of the medieval commentators, many of the Rishonim operate, is that they don't often actually ask the big thematic questions that seem to us to be the most important issues. You first take a story like the Akedah, you say, okay, well, what do we learn from the story? Often that is buried in some of the comments of the Rishonim, but very few of them actually have something like an introduction to the Perek, where they say, first and foremost, let's just talk about the big themes of the Perek, what it's about. You might have to actually find it buried, hinted at in various comments of the Rishonim. Most of the Rishonim we won't be able to touch on at all. We'll spend some significant time with the Rambam next week, because the Rambam, I think, builds a picture that's really immensely powerful what he does with it, but also what's sort of latent in what he says about the meaning of the story. But today we're going to spend most of our time with some modern thinkers. Modern thinkers, some Jewish, some not. But one of the reasons that we'll spend most of our time with modern thinkers is exactly because of what I just mentioned. Chazal and the Midrashim, they certainly raise some very important issues, but in a genre that's very unfamiliar to us, through Midrash. So sometimes it's a little story, sometimes it's a little interpretive comments. Again, they don't write big interpretive essays trying to flesh out what was going on in Avram's mind. The Rishonim, the Ramban is probably the most famous Rishon who does really try to reconstruct characters, states of mind sometimes. On the Akedah, he happens not to. He has a lot to say about the Akedah, but he doesn't do what he sometimes does, which is to really try to get into a character's mind and think of what were they thinking at this time, why would they respond in this way. So for the most part, and again, we'll talk about the Rambam next week, but for the most part, the Rishonim also don't really bite off in an explicit way the most central question that seems to us to be the most basic question, which is, again, what's the story really about? People have argued that for Rashi, the story is fundamentally about chosenness, that it argues that Avram and then Yitzchak are the chosen people, and there are a number of hints in Rashi's commentary in this perek that's true, but it's nothing that Rashi, I can't give you the Rashi and say, see, here's where he asks the question, here's where he answers the question, as opposed to the modern writers who do exactly what we would expect them to do, and of course that's because we come from the same intellectual world that they do. In other words, they write the way that we would write. They ask a question, they say, here's my big topic, here's my thesis statement, here's my arguments for it, and here's my conclusion, which I think I've now justified. And if nothing else, just as a question of style, it makes it much easier for us to interact, to converse with people who write in a way that's the way we would write, the way that we're used to reading things. In modern times, as will become clear, this is not only in modern times, but in modern times, there's been a real focus on what you might call the anthropological or psychological aspects of the story. So what was Avram thinking? What did God want from Avram? Why did Avram respond the way he did? What was going through his head as he responded? This is obviously, in some examples, much more speculative than we might be comfortable with. And I'm not going to try to speculate as to what he might have been thinking at any given time or or what he might have said to Yitzchak. But there's been a real focus on the character of Avraham and his experience in the Akedah. I'll mention one insight from Mordechai Martin Buber before getting into the bulk of what we're going to do this evening. Buber points out in an essay, which is actually written in response to an essay we're about to talk about, Buber points out that Avram's first and last test, and this is wonderful for this week, because we just read his first test, and we're going to get the Akedah this coming Shabbat. His first and last tests are mirror images of each other in an important way. The first test, at least according to the views, the 10 tests of Avram, which the Mishnah says existed, the Mishnah says there were 10 tests of Avram, but it doesn't say what they were. So it's left to later commentators to figure out what these 10 tests might have been. Some opinions include tests that are not actually in the Torah, like very famously the fiery furnace that he might have been thrown into. But some Rishonim, like the Rambam, insist that the 10 tests have to actually be found in the text of the Torah. If that's true, then the first test has to have been Lech Lecha. The last test, very clearly, according to all opinions, is the Akedah. And Buber says, these are mirror images of each other in an important way. The first test, God asks Avraham, leave your past. Leave your father, who the Ramban points out, Rashi points out, is still alive. Leave him behind, and go off with me. I'm not even going to tell you where I'm going, just go with me. I'll promise you there's all sorts of rewards, and so on. And the last test is, now, forego all of those promises of the future. Remember, you gave up your past in the hopes of a future, but now I want you to sacrifice your son. Sacrifice your son, then there is no future. So the ultimate test, taking those two together, is, can Avram really say, in good faith to God, I am content to be with just you in the here and now. No past, no future, just me and you, wherever you may lead me. And that's an entirely terrifying notion of what the life of being tested was for Avram, but it's also a very insightful point about the first and last tests of Avram's life, and how dramatically this last test overturns everything that Avram has been counting on and building up to up until this point. So with that, I want to introduce the main character for today, who is Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard lived the first half of the 19th century, CE. To me, BCE seems more natural, but CE. In other words, just a little bit more than 200 years ago he was born, died in the 1840s, lived a short, incredibly prolific life, wrote a couple of dozen books, and was influential even in his own lifetime. The essay that we're going to be talking about is an essay called The Fear and Trembling. Fear and Trembling. And we'll talk a little bit later on today about how influential it was outside of Denmark, because it turns out that that's actually important for one of the issues that we want to consider. But Kierkegaard explicitly says that one of the reasons he's writing this essay, which is an essay entirely about the Akedah, it's all about the character of Avram at the Akedah, and the story of the Akedah, the reason he's writing this essay is that he is fed up with what he calls Christendom, and he doesn't see anyone actually practicing Christianity. There's this contrast between Christianity and Christendom. Christendom is, well, Denmark's a Christian country. More Christian in the early 19th century than America is today, but you might say, oh, America is a Christian country. So if you're born a Christian in a Christian country, aren't you Christian? And Kierkegaard is furious at that suggestion. But that's not Christian. Christian doesn't just mean I happen to be born into a Christian family, I celebrate Christmas, I live in a Christian country, so I'm off on the appropriate holidays. That's not what it means to be a Christian. For Kierkegaard, faith has to be overwhelming, it has to be entirely personal, individualistic, and it's something that I can't talk about with anyone else, really. I can't communicate to anyone else. I can't even describe to anyone else. It's something that's between me and God. if I try to explain it to you, all I can do is sort of water it down or talk about the symptoms of it or something like that. And then you could maybe say, oh yeah, I have the same symptoms or I, you know, experience it differently. But what it really is something that can never come outside of me because it's something entirely and intensely personal. And so he's very, very angry, and this is a part of the essay. He's very angry at preachers in Copenhagen who preach about the faith of Abraham and say, you know, Abraham is the model of faith. After all, Abraham was prepared because of his faith to even sacrifice his own son. That's the kind of faith we should all be aspiring to. He's a real man of faith and a hero to all of us. And Kierkegaard says, they don't even mean it. How do I know they don't mean it? Because if I actually met them in the street and said, I'm going to sacrifice my son today because I've been inspired by your sermons, I'm really a man of faith, and that's what I've been moved to do, God has called me to sacrifice my child, they would probably appropriately try to stop me. Because they don't really believe that that's what faith is. They don't really believe that they understand Abraham, and that's what his real message is in the book. We'll have to talk a little bit more about all the details, but his core claim is, I can never understand Abraham. I can never understand anyone who's a real person of faith. Faith is something that no one from the outside can ever really understand. And so he says, there might be lots of Avrahams around. He says he himself has never experienced anything like Avraham's experience, and I'll in a minute try to articulate what he thinks Avraham's experience was, but he says, I've never experienced anything like it. That doesn't mean that I doubt that other people do. It could be that every other person in this room has experienced something like Avraham's faith. I would never know, though, because on the outside, they would look like anyone else. Only intensely and deeply personally would they have been changed, would they have been moved by this experience. And I wouldn't pretend to be able to understand them or even to be able to recognize them. There's nothing external about faith. Faith is something so intensely personal that, again, not claiming to be, he says he's not claiming to be a real person of faith, never having experienced anything of the sort, but he wouldn't deny anyone else's claim that they have had it. He simply doesn't think he can understand it. He doesn't think he can really relate to it until he experiences it, which until this point he hasn't. So on the second page, on the back of the first page, I have I call it a somewhat unfair summary of Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling. It's somewhat unfair because the essay, it's not a very long book as books go. Depending on the printing, it's 100, 110, 120 pages. But obviously, there's no fair way to summarize even a short book in four paragraphs. So this is somewhat unfair, but it also seems somewhat unfair to, you know, pause now and let everyone read the book and then reconvene. So given the options, here's our somewhat unfair summary. And I'll just sort of speak this out loud, more or less the way it's written here. One of the things that Kierkegaard very much wants to react to is the notion, which is probably most familiar from Kant, but he finds it elsewhere, that the only guiding principles of life are what Kant calls ethics, and what he means by ethics are universal ethics. So the only guiding principles of life, the only valid guiding principles of life, are things that I can do that are applicable in all cases. I can articulate the rule for why I'm doing this. I'm doing this because, in the following circumstances, this is the proper thing to do. So, it's wrong to kill. Kant has sort of a blunt edge with his ethics, but it's wrong to kill. So therefore, it's just wrong to kill. I'm not killing because it's always wrong to kill. If I wanted to claim that in this case it is not wrong to kill, then I have to articulate why in this case it is, what are the circumstances, what's the justification. In other words, you should be able to take that and replicate it. You should be able to say, okay, look, here's the rule. He did this because of the following circumstances. If there are ever similar circumstances, I now know what the rule is. And Kierkegaard thinks that this is overly simplistic, that life just doesn't work that way, especially when it comes to faith. That there are times in life when someone, and Avraham's going to be his primary example, when someone needs to do something that they can't explain why they need to do it. That there's something that actually is not articulable. They can't say, because of the following circumstances, let's say, take a hypothetical, I must kill my son. He actually can't explain at all why he's killing his son. But he knows he has to. And this is what Kierkegaard calls the suspension of the ethical. You have the ethical, you have ethics, you have the realm of ethics that normally governs us, and Kierkegaard certainly thinks that normally ethics should govern us, but sometimes you need to suspend ethics. You need to say there's something here that's greater, something here that's more important than the ethical, and for a purpose, for one particular purpose, I need to be able to suspend the ethical. So the fancy word that he uses for a purpose is teleological, right? For an end. So this is his phrase, which you actually have, I think, on the back of the back of that page. Is there a teleological suspension of the ethical? And that's the name of one of his chapters. And of course, his answer is absolutely yes. There certainly is a teleological suspension of the ethical. In other words, there are times that a person of faith has to go outside of the realm of ethics in order to do something that's demanded by God. So that's the sort of framing insight that he has into the entire story. You see the quote at the end of that first paragraph. By his act, he, meaning Avram, overstepped the ethical entirely and possessed a higher telos outside of it, in relation to which he suspended the former. Now, what are the universal ethical norms that Kierkegaard says Avram is violating? What are the ethical norms that Avram is violating here? Okay, so the first obvious one is murder, right? Seems no one would argue that's an ethical norm, right? In any ethical system, there's don't kill people. So he has to argue that in this case, even though that's normally an ethical norm, it was suspended for a reason. Then he adds what seems like a more trivial one, but a more specific one, sort of more case-specific. What else is Avram not doing? Caring for his child. Exactly, right? So he should be caring for his child. He should be not killing. Put those two together. You certainly should not be killing your own child. And yet Avram had to. He had to. Now, you see in the first, in that second paragraph, in the middle, there's a key line, I think. He says, the ethical expression for what Avram did is that he intended to murder Isaac. The religious expression is that he intended to sacrifice Isaac. Right? So it all depends on what lenses you're looking at this act through. As an ethicist, you say, he's taking an innocent child, or adult, doesn't really matter, bringing him up to a mountain, and slitting his throat. That's murder. There's no two ways about this. There's nothing ambiguous about this at all. The only way you could have come to any other conclusion is if you're not looking at it from an ethical perspective, but from a religious perspective. But, of course, there's only one person who can look at it from a religious perspective. Right? Only Avram can claim that he's sacrificing it. And Kierkegaard actually says very clearly that if anyone else were there, they would appropriately and legitimately arrest Avram, throw him into jail, do whatever it is you do to murderers, and Avram would have no defense. Because he can't say, but I am not a murderer, I am a sacrificer. That only makes sense. Beino leben HaKadosh Baruch Hu, beino leben Shaar Bnei Adam, in other words, in the eyes of all the rest of humanity, this is murder. Humanity can't be governed by my personal faith. It can only be governed by the rules of ethics, enshrined in law. And this is murder. Despite the fact that it was murder, here we come to the sort of psychological and theological question. So it's murder. So then why is Avram doing it? Avram was prepared to do it anyway. Why did he do it? You see, I have the quote in the third paragraph. A little bit enigmatic, but for God's sake, and in complete identity with this, for his own sake. What does that mean? Well, here we've come to the point where Kierkegaard stops making sense, and he says that he has to stop making sense, because this brings us back to the point of not being able to communicate in a real experience of faith. All right, to talk about proofs for God, talk about religious practices, that's easy. But to talk about an experience, an actual faith experience, that's something that Kierkegaard says is impossible for anyone to communicate. So he says, Avram just cannot talk. If he were arrested, it's not that he would offer a defense that would be rejected. He wouldn't be able to articulate a defense. What would he say? He would be able to say, what would he say? He would say, I heard voices, they told me to kill. He would say, okay, then maybe it's not a death penalty, maybe you get locked up in an asylum. Right? There's nothing you can say that could possibly communicate the magnitude of the experience of faith. And Kierkegaard says, that's why Avram has to be all alone on the mountain. Right? Because it's not just Lu Yitzuyar, he was arrested, he would not have been able to say. He can't talk. No one can learn anything from this experience. There's nothing that he can talk to anyone else about. Nothing that he wants anyone to learn anything from. He can't talk to his wife about it. He can't talk to his servants about it. He can't talk to Yitzchak about it. He can't talk to anybody about it. All he can do is experience it, and then, because the experience is so overwhelming, act on it. But there's no communication that's possible here at all. And Kierkegaard calls him a knight of faith, which he contrasts with a lot of other characters that he that he discusses that we won't get into now. But he says, a knight of faith, a true knight of faith, is a witness, never a teacher, because there's nothing to teach. It's something that was so intensely personal that there's nothing that can be said. And so he says, I can look at Abraham, I can admire Abraham, I cannot learn from Abraham. I can't try to be like Abraham. He even says, if the same thing happened to him, as happened to Abraham, he doesn't know how he would respond. He doesn't know if he has it in him to be a knight of faith. I don't know until it happens, and again, it's not something that I could possibly really relate to. So Abraham, you see, again, the quotes in the very last paragraph, Abraham keeps silent because he cannot speak. And therein lies the distress and the anguish. For if I, when I speak, am unable to make myself intelligible, then I'm not speaking. Now Abraham is able to say the most beautiful things any language can express about how he loves Isaac. But it is not this he has at heart to say. It is the profounder thought that he would sacrifice him because it is a trial. The latter thought no one can understand, and hence everyone can only misunderstand the former. Okay. So again, this is somewhat unfair to Kierkegaard to sum up his essay in such a short synopsis, but I don't think it was inaccurate summary. I think this is, you know, we've now, I think, hit upon the major ideas in the essay. If anyone does want to read it between, I guess especially between now and next week, I'd be of limited time. So it's especially Problema 1, where he really lays out what you have the first page of on the back here. Is there a teleological suspension of the ethical? That's where he really gets the core of what I think his thinking is about the issue. Although, sort of predictably, like any great essay, there is a massive amount written about Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling and whether there are other messages involved. But we'll set those aside. I think we've done at least adequate justice to the central claims that Kierkegaard makes here. Okay. Now, of course, Kierkegaard is a great thinker. He's, you know, clearly a very, very intelligent person. But doesn't necessarily speak for the Jewish tradition in terms of what the Akedah teaches. And we might actually want to say that he speaks against the Jewish tradition in some way. I'm not going to, again, give you a long list of quotations, but there are a number of Jewish thinkers in the 20th century who read Kierkegaard and said, this is anathema to everything that Judaism believes. Because Kierkegaard's basic claim that religion can sometimes stand against morality is actually not an easy claim to swallow. So I'll just mention one, but next week we'll encounter a couple of others. Milton Steinberg, who's probably most famous as the author as A Driven Leaf, but a very important reform thinker in the mid-20th century, has an essay about the Akedah, in which he discusses Kierkegaard and says that Kierkegaard's view is abhorrent to Judaism. In Jewish thought, the ethical is never suspended, certainly not for God, especially not for God. On the contrary, there's nothing that God would ask anyone to do that's unethical. And there's something sort of distinctly Reform in that thinking, because certainly in Reform Jewish thought, and I say this with Schwach, the ethical aspects of Judaism are elevated to the most central place in religious thinking. But that's not an unfair statement for Jewish thought more generally, although there certainly have been different reactions from Jewish thinkers across the spectrum in the 20th century, and again, we'll come back to some of them next week. I want to look at one Jewish thinker who seemed to have accepted Kierkegaard's thinking about the story, sort of hook, line, and sinker, like totally bought into it. We talked about this. And then spend the rest of the time this evening articulating why I think, despite what we've set up until now, articulating why I think this is actually not. Not a correct, but not an acceptable way of reading the story of the Akedah, and pointing the way towards what I hope to be able to develop next week, which is a more Jewish and a more, what I think is acceptable way of of really getting at the heart of the story. But first, the Jewish Kierkegaardian. There are a number, but the one I want to look at is Yeshaya Leibowitz. You have an excerpt from him, which is unfortunately a little bit blurry, on the top of the last page. Yeshaya Leibowitz, some of you, I'm sure know of him. Some of you might have known him. I don't know what he's most famous for. So I guess first of all, he's Nachama Leibowitz's brother. So that's, he's famous for that. He was actually a professor of chemistry in Yerushalayim, but he was Nachama Leibowitz's brother. They grew up in the same house. They grew up incredibly erudite Jewishly, and for decades in Yerushalayim, he had a weekly sicha in his home, often discussing, often centered around the Parsha, sometimes centered around the Rambam. And some of the really major Israeli intellectuals gathered around Leibowitz regularly or sporadically. And he was, partly I think because he was a professor of chemistry, it's sort of not obligated to articulate a systematic philosophy of anything. He was able to say a lot of things that just very, very smart, very insightful, but that I'm not even sure he really wanted to carry out in sort of all the way to the end. He says things that are very, very challenging. What we're going to see right now, though, is something that he's actually very consistent about. So let me frame this with what might be a potential question, a potential objection to Kierkegaard. You might say to Kierkegaard, well, look, that's a lovely, lovely reading of the text, at least part of the text, and we'll come back to some other objections soon. But after all, achar hadvirim ha'ele, after these things, Elohim yisad Abraham, God tested Abraham. According to you, what does it have to do with anything that came beforehand? It has nothing to do with anything. God is doing whatever he was doing, and then, boom, after this he decided to have him slaughter his son. What does it have to do with what came beforehand, achar hadvirim ha'ele, what came right beforehand? So that's the question that Leibowitz actually tackles. Leibowitz says, well, what did come beforehand? Depending on what exactly you think is beforehand. But he says, well, there's a number of stories that are sort of in the Prakim leading up to Perek Chaf Bet. So let's start with Perek Yud Tet. Perek Yud Tet, God comes to Avram and says, I'm about to destroy the cities of Sodom and Amorah. Well, what does Avram say? Don't do it. Why? On what ground should he not do it? It's unethical, right? Shafei Kolar is Lo'yaseh Mishpat. It's unjust. It's unethical. God, you're the judge of the whole land. How could you just go destroy? There's no problem destroying wicked people, right? But how could you destroy the righteous people along with wicked people? This is something that God of all characters can't do, right? So says Avram. And God engages in innocent negotiation and destroys Sodom and Amorah. Then in Perek Chaf, Avram goes to Grar. And Avimelech is the king of Grar. And Avimelech, you remember the story, takes Sarah. And when Avimelech finds out what had happened, he calls in Avram and he says, Avram, what did you do to this? What did you do to us? I'm sorry. Right? How could you have done this to us? And Avram says, Vayomer Abraham, this is in Perek Chaf, Pasuk Yud Aleph, Ki amarti rak in yirat Elokim b'makom hazeh. I thought what? Ein yirat Elokim. No fear of God. But what does fear of God clearly mean here? He doesn't care if they're religious. What does he mean? Ethics, right? I thought there was no morality here. You don't need to be very religious to not murder someone to steal their wife, right? You just need to be sort of basically moral to not do that. So Avram says, I thought there was no yirat Elokim, meaning I thought there was no morality here at all. But Leibowitz says, but look at Avram's term again, right? Avram's conflating yirat Elokim with morality. Because morality is fear of God. Okay, but in Avram's thought, that seems consistent. After all, in the last parak, he just said, God, you can't kill the people. God, it has to be moral. So God, morality, it seems to be a sort of running theme in Avram's thought. I'll skip Perek Chaf Aleph for now, although Leibowitz has something to say about it. He says, that's exactly what the Akedah wants to teach Avram. God wanted to teach something to Avram very important in what Leibowitz thinks is religious thought. That Avram's been making a very, very important mistake up until now. Avram has thought that religion, that faith, has something to do with ethics and morality. And so God gives him a command that is grossly unethical, entirely immoral, right? In order to teach him that you actually sometimes have to make a choice. You can be Yirat Elokim, Yirei Elokim, or you can be moral, but those are not the same, and don't confuse the two. And Leibovitz actually thinks that God was angry, so to speak. He would never anthropomorphize God, but God was angry. He said, "Why do you keep talking about me when you talk about ethics? Of course you should be a good person. Of course you shouldn't kill people and steal their wives. That's obvious. But don't blame it on me. It has nothing to do with me. You want to be a Yirei Elokim? I'll teach you what it means to be a Yirei Elokim. What it means to be a Yirei Elokim is to do what God says, no matter what your own intuitions are. You want to be ethical? Of course you should be ethical. But don't confuse that with religion." In the passage you have in front of you, he says that there are lots of people, Chasidei ha-monotheism ha-eti, right? The Chasidim of ethical monotheism, who want to empty religion of all of its faith component and reduce it to ethics and morality. Says, oh, that's exactly what Avram thought when he said, God, Chalil lecha, Shafet kol ha'aretz, and so on. But, Leibovitz says, in a sort of characteristically sharp expression, does he know who these people are actually worshipping when they want to be ethical? They're just worshipping their own moral intuitions. In other words, they're worshipping humanity, or, as he says, they're idolatrous. They're not worshipping God. They might want to claim that they're worshipping God, but in fact, they're idolatrously worshipping human intuitions and calling it God. So, again, this is something that's too jarring to really want to push to the end. It's hard to imagine even Leibovitz wanting to claim, although he claims over and over, that that religion is amoral entirely. It has no ethical, no moral content whatsoever. But I think it is clear for our purposes that this is at the very minimum taking a starting point from Kierkegaard, seeing in the story of the Akedah the clash between ethics and faith and religion, and that God set up an episode where Avram had to actually choose: do I want to be a Yirei Elokim or do I want to be ethical? At this point, I can only be one. We all pray to not ever have to make that choice. But Avram was forced with a command, divine command, that was obvious to him was unethical, obvious to him was immoral, and so he had to decide, am I going to be Yirei Elokim, or am I going to be ethical? And chose to be Yirei Elokim, which, as the story says, he's rewarded for it. So that's a Kierkegaardian reading, but a Kierkegaardian reading that really puts it into the literary context, sort of brings it into the narrative of Avram. One last Jewish text source that I'll mention, but I gave it to you in translation because I didn't think we'd have a lot of time, and we don't have a lot of time to really work through it. But this is from the Malbim, from the commentary of the Malbim on Bereishis, on the Akedah. And let's look at it first, and then I'll just say something about why I think this is significant beyond just being interesting. So this is on Pasuk K, Shulachem Poem Achamor, and the Malbim says that here's how the test is different from everything that Avram did until now. Because everything that Avram did until now involved commandments which did not violate his intellect. Right? Which is actually, I think, a pretty standard way of understanding Avram, that he intuitively understood what it was that God wanted, which means, of course, that what God wanted made sense. Someone, a great person, but someone down on earth could have come up with, sort of reconstructed what it was that Ratzon Hashem was. But this command was different. It violated his intellect. Until now, he had argued against idolaters who offered human sacrifices, arguing that God didn't want such abominations. There was no greater abomination in God's eyes than homicide. And now, at this command, which violated his intellect and violated God's good ways. Hebrew, Batzak Asher Yatu Mitzvah Zo, She Neged Aseichel, Ve Neged Derechei Hashem HaTovim. Why is that so important? Why is that line so important? It's not just that Avram thinks that it doesn't make sense, right? What does the Malbim say? It's against God's will. Right? The command reached him. The command itself is actually against God's will. Not just, as the Chassam Sofer actually says, that Avram started thinking, I wonder if it was against God's will. But the Malbim is willing to say, black on white, this is against Ratzon Hashem. This is not Ratzon Hashem, which of course we can make sense of because we know the end of the story. Right? But Avram, at least as he's living through it, can't possibly make sense of that. And so he's racked with anxiety. I don't know what to do with this. I just got a command. As far as I understood God, this is against everything I understood. What do I do? So when this reached him, he did not want to fulfill it in front of his servants, for he was ashamed to do something in front of them, which until now he had held to be an abomination. But he also did not, and he also did not want them to learn to do likewise. Therefore he hid it from them and said, Nelchav v'nashuva alechem, right? We will bow down and we will return to you. And as the Malbim says, this is not like a nevuah. Avram is simply tricking the servants. He says, we're going together. We're going to go nishtachaveh. We're going to come back together because he doesn't want them to chas v'shalom learn anything from what he's about to do. Right? Why? Because as far as he can tell, it's wrong what he's about to do. Right? So again, at the end of the story, we can say he was right in thinking that it was wrong. Right? Which he couldn't have made sense of at the time, but afterwards he could have made sense of. It was right to think that it was wrong because it turns out that God stopped him. At the time, he couldn't possibly have had any idea of how this is all going to resolve itself. He just knew that it made no sense. And he was sure that his avadim and his wife and anyone else, all the people that he had been teaching for the last few decades about monotheism, about the good way of life, about Ratzon Hashem, about being whatever it was that he called it at that point, he didn't want them to learn anything from what was happening now. He couldn't fathom how this could possibly be Ratzon Hashem. So this was the core principle in this test, that he did God's command, which went against his intellect and against the right and the just and the good ways of God, and still did not second guess God. This act, which God in fact did not desire, right, Shebemet lo ratza Hashem bo, and had Avram slaughtered Yitzchak, it would have been an act of murder and an abomination to God. This act was opposed by a spiritual being, which sees the secrets of the higher wisdom. He was therefore ashamed to do it in front of his servants, just as one is normally ashamed to commit an abominable act where others can see. So, when I first came across this a number of years ago, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I was, wow, sounds like Kierkegaard. The Malbim's 19th century. His commentary is published around 1870. Is it possible that he read Kierkegaard, that he's heard of Kierkegaard? Did a little bit of research. The Malbim was actually more worldly than I think we sometimes get the impression. He did read German. He read Kant in German. He read a number of the sort of maskilic periodicals that were circulating then, Kerem Chemed, Bikurei Ha'itim. He was involved, at least on the periphery, of the of Jewish Wissenschaft world in Central Europe in the late 19th century. He was also a more complicated personality than I had known before that, and kept losing jobs because his congregants didn't like him, and they thought he wasn't doing a good enough job articulating their needs to the government, and he actually spent a lot of time in a lot of different countries because of that. But the notion that he read Kierkegaard falls apart on a pretty simple fact. Kierkegaard, although I said he was influential in his own lifetime, is influential in Denmark in his own lifetime. His work actually wasn't translated into German until the same exact year that Malbim's commentary on the Torah first appeared. So there's no way that the Malbim read Danish, and there's also no way that that he read it, wrote it, and published it all within the course of a couple of months. And so we can't really think that the Malbim read Kierkegaard. And as far as I can tell, people weren't really talking about Kierkegaard in Central Europe, again, besides Denmark itself, in the decades before that. Which makes it actually a more interesting question. Because it means it's not a question of influence, that someone read someone else and said, that's a good insight, I'm going to adopt that. It's something deeper. Because this is a notion, let's sort of formulate this very concisely. The idea that the Akedah forces Avram to choose between religious faith and ethics is something that I can't find anywhere before the 1800s. In the 1800s, at least in a sort of that bald form, in the 1800s, you have a hint of it actually in the Chatam Sofer, as I mentioned, the Malbim, Ktav HaKabbalah goes in a similar direction, Kierkegaard, and then of course, once you get to the 20th century, you have a lot of people talking about it, but then you already have people reading those people from the 19th century. So the question is actually more interesting than just a question of influence. It's a question of, well, why all of a sudden are people thinking of the Akedah in this way? Why are people suddenly thinking, and I don't want to claim it's really sudden, but like, you know, in the year 1812, everyone started thinking of the Akedah in this way. Even if it slowly sort of snowballed or became an intuitive way of thinking about it, something they don't find in the Rishonim, at least, again, in the articulated in the same way, why in the 19th century does it become sort of the attractive way of reading the story of the Akedah as a conflict between faith and ethics? And while it's impossible to give a totally precise answer, and certainly not the time we have, I'll just suggest that the 18th into the 19th century was a time where what Kierkegaard was talking about becomes a sort of fact of life. That you have countries where ethics, nationalities, Christendom is actually out of the official religion of the state, right? Starting in the late 18th century. In other words, you no longer have a state telling you that you are a Protestant or you are a Catholic because you now live in a Catholic country, you live in a Protestant country. It's the official state religion. You start to actually not have official state religions in the 19th century, even if you have de facto state religions. But instead, you have this sort of communal religion that everyone says, well, you know, we are Danish Christians. And Kierkegaard and others start to say, well, that actually seems to be in conflict with what we think real religion is, which is not to be outsourced to the community and say, like, we are group X or group Y, but religion has to be personal. If it's not going to be a state religion, which it no longer is, then it can't just be sort of a soft power, you know, this is what the community is, but it has to really be intensely personal. And so Kierkegaard and the Malbim and the Chasam Sofer and a number of other thinkers all start thinking of this story as exemplifying sort of clash between the conventional wisdom, in other words ethics, what everyone tells each other to do, what the expectations are for sort of normal civil behavior, and real faith. Real faith is no longer in the hands of the state. Real faith now has to be in the hands of the individual. The individual has to be able to move beyond the community, move outside of the communal structures, and really experience religion on a personal level. So again, that's really not even well articulated or well developed. But I do think that there's something about religious life in Europe in the 19th century that leads thinkers from very different backgrounds who are not engaged with each other to still think about the Akedah in new ways that turn out to have a lot in common with each other. Okay, so now, in the last few minutes, having said all that about Kierkegaard and about the Malbim and so on, I'd like to raise the issues that I think make Kierkegaard's view. I'm just going to use Kierkegaard for the as shorthand for everyone else who says the same thing. What makes his view very problematic? You can break up the problems into two types of problems. So let me start with the simpler one. The simpler one is a literary problem, a textual problem. Kierkegaard never, in the entire book, really grapples with the fact that that's not how the story ends. The whole story, according to Kierkegaard, is about the command to sacrifice Yitzchak. But of course, that's only the first half of the story. There is a second half of the story in which Hashem commands him not to sacrifice Yitzchak. For Kierkegaard, that's almost trivial, accidental, sort of an afterthought, like, well, once we've already set up, this is not implausible, but once we've already set up the test, once you've already passed the test, you don't actually have to go through with the bloody part, because why bother? We've set up the test, you've made your correct decision, you get rewarded for it, so, you know, might as well spare our life while we're at it. That's not an absurd reading. It is possible that saving Yitzchak is actually not the crux of it. But I do think that's not... We have to at least entertain the possibility that actually the first half is a very important half, but the second half might be equally important, that Hashem's first tzivui, the ha'alei sham le'olah, to offer Yitzchak as a sacrifice, is indeed half of the point, but that the second part, right, don't do anything, is equally important, not just an afterthought, but really central to the story. And Kierkegaard makes no attempt to grapple with the fact that he doesn't actually, that Avram doesn't actually go through with killing Yitzchak. It seems like that should play a larger role in understanding what the story is actually about. So that's on a textual or literary level. On the level of thought, though, and here I think one has to decide what the assumptions are of our thought before we can formulate an assumption. But let's be clear about what the sort of ultimate knight of faith is according to Kierkegaard. It's someone who's entirely solitary. Right? The ultimate religious experience involves no other human beings. Communal experience is not real, genuine religious experience in this reading. That's something that's a facade, it's superficial, it's something that we do because we enjoy it, it makes us feel good, maybe it brings us a sense of euphoria even, but that's not real religious faith. Real religious faith, in Kierkegaard's claim, in his reading, can only be, again, an intensely solitary experience. And that's a claim that seems to be open to question. It's open to question. In other words, you could say, well, is that really how Jewish thought is set up? Halakha, for example. It's not to say that there are no sources that say that tefillah biyachid, or biyachidut, cannot be transcendental, can be incredibly powerful experience, but the fundamental religious experience is not set up as a solitary experience, set up actually as a communal experience. Could that be taken actually as an objection? That Kierkegaard, you're claiming that the ultimate experience with God is between me and God, no one else. I can't talk to anyone, I can't experience with anyone, I can't have anyone else around, that can only detract from the authenticity of my experience. And maybe that's just not true, maybe that's not really what religion is. I understand that you, Mr. Kierkegaard, experience religion that way, but I'm not sure that that's the way religion works for me. I'm not sure that that's the way that Judaism believes that the sort of deepest religious experiences are really meant to be experienced. Maybe, not only from a Jewish perspective, but maybe from a sort of more human perspective, is it fair to really take fellow human beings out of religion? So that my interactions with other human beings, they themselves can't be religious. Is that fair? Now, Kierkegaard's claim is, real religion is between me and God. Right? What about his... I can't even imagine how profound the relationship was between Avram and Sarah as they together left their homeland and spent decades alone, right? Not like a young couple who chooses to wait till they're, the ripe old age of 24 before having a child so they can have a whole 2 years of time together. They have decades and decades, just the two of them, in a foreign land with no one else around. How profound was that relationship between Avram and Sarah? And Kierkegaard claims, that may or may not have been profound, it's not religious. Right, religious is only when Avram encounters God without Sarah there. You might say, is that really fair? Is that doing justice to the interpersonal relationships that we might actually be familiar with, that some of us do experience as spiritual, as transcendent, as spiritually meaningful? In other words, have you actually sapped life of much of what many people actually think is religiously meaningful, namely, specifically the interpersonal relationships that give religious meaning to life. That's a question to ask Kierkegaard. There have been some people who have claimed that there's sort of a biographical aspect to Kierkegaard's essay. He had recently broken off an engagement to Regine Olsen, who is famous for having been engaged to Soren Kierkegaard and then not. By the time he wrote the book, the essay, just a year later, she was already married to someone else. But he explicitly says that he wrote it in part to explain why he needed to not be engaged to her. But again, is that actually something that we want to hold up as a model of religious experience, that one has to break off all human relationships, as he claims Avram did to Sarah, and to Yitzhak and to Zavadim and to everyone else who had learned from him, as he himself had just done? Is that the only way to get to real religious faith, is to have no other human connection? That seems, it seems to not do justice to much of what we actually, I'll speak just for myself, treasure about my own life, my own relationships, my own, I'll say, spiritual experiences in the world, have actually a lot to do with people and community, and intimate relationships that are developed. And the solitariness is important as part of religion, but to say that that's the only legitimate religious experience and nothing else is real religion, nothing else is real faith, maybe I at least would resist, not because it's a bad reading of the Akedah necessarily, although I've already suggested why I think it's not a great reading of the Akedah, but because the conclusions are so challenging in terms of what life would be like then. And I should always be aspiring to the life of a monk, which has never been the Jewish ideal. It's always been a contrast.
It makes me think of Nazirut. What does Kierkegaard say about the Nazirut? Did he say that that's...
Well, Nazirut is in the direction, but remember, even Nazirut doesn't have to cut off his human relationships. He can't drink wine, can't be mitameh lemeit. Right. Still be married. Right? There's a lot of things that are still perfectly legitimately on the table.
He's called a
Nazir. Look, I think it's without nuancing this too much, I think it's fair to say that from 2,000 years ago or so, it was a big machlokas between Judaism and Christianity whether the ultimate religious experience was by withdrawing from the world or by immersing oneself in the world. Now, that's totally oversimplifying something that's very complicated on both sides, but I think it's not unfair to say that I hear Kierkegaard, but that sounds a lot more Christian than it does Jewish. One second, sorry. Okay, the last thing that I'll mention, and this I had said early on, but one of the emails that wound up on one of the early flyers. It's not that hard to go from Kierkegaard's reading of the Akedah to beheading people in the desert in Syria. Now, that's a very overreaching statement, but let's be clear about what's being said. Right? The claim is that Avram, to all other eyes, is a murderer. But in his own eyes, he's a sacrificer. He's a makriv, right? The ultimate religious experience. Now, it would be appropriate for us to arrest him and convict him and put him in jail. It's fine. But, of course, since no one did, instead, we actually put him on a pedestal, and Kierkegaard says, we don't learn from him, we can't learn from him, but we admire him, we admire what he's done, because we believe, we take his word, we take the Torah's word, for the claim that he did it because God told him to do it. Now, that's an impossible claim to assess. As Kierkegaard says, I don't know what you're experiencing right now. I don't know what your faith is. And if it's really so intensely personal, it's so internal, now all I can say is that I've never, thank God, had any religious experience that asked me to do anything remotely similar to what the claim is that Avram had. Okay, so that's fine, but what if you say you did? On what grounds could I, in good faith, say it's impossible, there's no way, and you're an obviously evil person? I can say you're unethical and I'm going to punish you, that's one thing. But I might not be able to actually say you're irreligious and you're lying, because after all, if you say God told you to, how could I possibly know that God didn't tell you to? Now, I don't really want to claim that it's a short step and that everyone is Abraham or potentially Abraham, but the notion that religion can be and sometimes is against ethics, and against ethics in a way that is not subject to scrutiny from anyone else. Right? No one else can say, well, you can't do that because it's unethical. I can do it even though I know it's unethical, because there is a teleological suspension of the ethical. There are simply things more important than ethics. But that's a troubling claim. It opens the door, again, I'm not claiming that Kierkegaard is widely read in the deserts of Syria, and that's where they're getting their ideas from. But I personally want to be able to articulate why it's not possible that the Akedah could be a precedent for anything that's going on in such an abhorrent way in Syria. I want to be able to say, here's why there's nothing in the Jewish tradition that could legitimize that.
No, I don't remember Kierkegaard that well from what he read in 5 years ago, but does he claim this as a sort of analysis of Abraham's experience, a one-time analysis? In other words, I don't remember either that he actually claimed this as a general condition, that one has teleological suspensions.
That's about right.
But rather than that, he was assessing what went on in Abraham's mind.
Right. So I have the advantage of having read it last week. He does say very explicitly that he can't say that every other person next to him hasn't had a similar experience to Avram. He can't deny that claim, because I can't possibly know what you've had vis-a-vis God. Avram couldn't have talked, and you couldn't have talked, and no one else here could have talked about that kind of relationship. You could make sounds about it, but you can't really articulate it. And so I can't say that you didn't have it. And he actually says, if he met someone, he would not be able to verify or deny it. He would only have to stand in awe of them if they claimed to have been this kind of knight of faith. In general, he's skeptical that anyone in his immediate surroundings really a man of faith.
Know that God was speaking to you.
Right.
Right. Well, that's the condition.
You
would have to know.
Yeah, exactly. But that's again unverifiable, right? So all you have to do is say, I know that God wants me to do X, Y, or Z, and I might say it's unethical, but I can't say, according to Kierkegaard, I can't say, no, you're not really acting as a person of faith. As it's not really a religious act.
He knows that Abraham knew that that was God.
He believes because it's in the Torah, right.
Well, because he's a believer and a man of faith, he knows that Abraham knew. He does not know that in that instance.
That's exactly right.
That's
exactly right, but I would say that's not good enough. I don't want to be able to say to them...
Not enough so it doesn't easily transfer to beheading.
No, but I think it's not good enough to say, well, I can't really be sure that God has spoken to them, because I don't really believe them. I think they might just be crazy. I want to be able to say, I know for a fact that this is not a religious act, that this is not a religiously acceptable act by any account. Certainly not, I mean, some other religion might license it, but my religion would never license anything like that. That's what I would like to be able to say. Now again, that's an assumption. I mean, you might say, no, it's just not true. Maybe Judaism's okay with a claim that sometimes you could do horrible things in the name of religion. Right, exactly. So that's I think the problems with Kierkegaard are. Again, there's the textual problem that he doesn't account for the entire second half of the story, for the fact that Avram doesn't kill Yitzchak. But there's also philosophical problems that he privileges this very solitary religious experience. It's the only real religious experience. It's not just that interpersonal relationships are stripped of their religious meaning, but he claims that Avram has to actually violate all his interpersonal relationships in order to get real religious meaning. And the implication of all of that, that then there's really no way of anyone assessing anyone else's religious actions as legitimately or illegitimately religiously positive. You could say they're unethical, but he's claimed that there are times when people have to do things that are unethical, and that's for a good reason. It might even be justified. All right. So let me just sketch out what my hopes are for next week, and the hopes that some of you would join me. For next week, what I'd like to do next week is to actually direct our attention much more to the second half of the story, to the stream of interpretation, especially the Jewish interpretation, that actually says the nisayon, the test, was a major part of the story, but the real crux of the story is when God tells Avram to not sacrifice Yitzchak, because that's where the core lesson of the Akedah is, and especially using the Rambam, but a couple of other Jewish thinkers as well, really try to articulate, well, what is the lesson of that second half of the story? What is the lesson that God is teaching Avram, and more importantly, God is teaching all of the readers of the Torah, in actually telling him, Al tishlach echal anarav, al taslu muma. Despite the fact that he's Yireh Elokim, there's something more to be learned by actually not sacrificing Yitzchak. So that's what I hope to do next week. I apologize for going over time. Thank you for your indulgence.